Leaders Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Brian Gruley. Now, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yes, you did.
All right. Brian, and that's Brian with a Y, just like my brother, the less common spelling. Brian is the award-winning, critically acclaimed author of the forthcoming thriller Bitterfrost, which we're talking about today, and he's also the author of the Starvation Lake trilogy, the first book of which was nominated for an Edgar Award and won many other awards. And when he's not making things up, Gruley lives in northern Lower Michigan with his wife, Pam, and enjoys ice hockey, golf, guitar, and his five grandchildren. He was a journalist for over 40 years and shared in the Wall Street Journal's Pulitzer Prize coverage of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and he's won numerous awards for his nonfiction. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Brian.
Hi, Monica. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So you were a journalist in your day job. At what point did you start writing novels, and why?
Well, you know, ever since I was young, I dreamt of writing novels. But when you're young, A, I didn't have the skill, and I'm talking in my 20s and 30s, and B, especially as in my 20s, what am I going to write about? Going to the bar? So, you know, I didn't have much to say. And, but the itch, it really got to me after I read Dennis Lehane's Mystic River. Hmm. I mean, I've been reading novels my whole life and short stories as well. And for some reason, when I read that, I thought, okay, this guy's a great writer. It's a great story. I got to try to do this. And so I came up with an idea, and I wrote about 25,000 words, and my agent didn't like it very much, but this would have been the year 2001. And she said, why don't you write me a story about these middle-aged guys who play hockey in the middle of the night? And I immediately had an idea.
Wait, agent came up with the concept?
Well, she knew I was a hockey player.
Okay.
And I talked to her about it.
And
we decided to set it in northern Lower Michigan, in a fictional town called Starvation Lake. And it took me 4 years to write that book. And then there was another year and a half of rejections, 25 rejections. And then I got a 3-book deal. So, which is great news, except I had to write the other 2 books. That's how I got going. But going all the way back to when I was a little kid, when I first started reading the Hardy Boys in second grade, I made up my own version of the Hardy Boys, the Anderson twins, and I would write these stories out longhand and then read them to my classmates at St. Gemma Elementary School in Detroit.
And I bet you got a great reception for those.
Well, they certainly liked it better than math, spelling, science, etc.
So what are some of the ways that you have used the skills you gained as a journalist in novel writing?
A number of ways, really. I mean, first of all, economy of words. You can't go on and on. You're on a clock, and effectively on a clock with readers. So you got to get them into the paragraph and get them to the next one and then get them to the next one. So, you know, you're trying to write somewhat propulsively when you're writing narratives. I wrote a lot of long form narratives at the Detroit News, at the Journal, and at Bloomberg Businessweek. And that helped me think of stories in a way that where you're trying to maintain tension and suspense. You're not giving the reader all the answers right away. You're raising questions that eventually, like Chekhov's gun, you will answer and have the gun go off. And as well, you know, observation, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, that's how you gather all the little details for writing scenes that bring the reader there. Take that. Readers like to be there. They like to be in Starvation Lake. And or in whatever town I've invented. And that the other thing was, I did a lot of stories, particularly for the Journal, from small towns. I grew up in the suburb of Detroit, and I've never really lived in a small town per se, Monica, but I wrote from a lot of them. And one of the things I found was, regardless of how whatever big issue I was supposedly writing about, whenever I went to one of these towns, Hill City, Kansas, Regent, North Dakota, Stillwell, Oklahoma, it was always really about the personal politics, local politics, grudges, rivalries, et cetera. And that's my books, I think, reflect that.
I think so. And I think you're probably right. And that's true in the city, too. It's just that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's just maybe a little harder to get to know all the people that are involved in a big city politics, whereas in a small town,
yeah,
it might be
a little
easier.
There are pros and cons to writing. I've had scenes and stuff in big cities in my books, but mostly everything takes place in small towns. And, you know, a small town's easier to grasp. It's easier to describe. And it's, to some degree, to readers, it's somewhat unfamiliar because you're creating this place. On the other hand, in a big city, there's a lot of anonymity. Mm-hmm. Everybody doesn't know everybody.
Right.
And in a little town, when you're writing a scene, there's everybody in the diner knows the people who you were writing about. So you have to keep that in mind and incorporate it to some degree.
Now, do you always fictionalize the small towns? Are they always made up?
So far, yeah.
So far.
But, I mean, there are towns in my books that are real towns. But the main town, Starvation Lake in the first three, Bleak Harbor in the next two, and now Bitterfrost, those are all made-up towns.
Okay.
They're loosely based on.
That was my next question. Do you have a specific town in mind when you're writing it?
Yes. With Starvation Lake, the town was Bel Air, which is up this way, northern Michigan. And I worked as an intern at the little paper there when I was in between junior and senior years in college. And then Bleak Harbor looks a lot like Saugatuck, which is on the southwest. It's in southwestern Michigan on the lake, the big lake, where I did a story there for the Journal originally. I kind of like Saugatuck. And then Bitterfrost looks like Manistee, which sits on the western shore, central western shore of Michigan. And it has a river that runs from Lake Michigan right through the middle of town. And I went there for the Journal like 20 some years ago to write a story about a guy who killed a buck with his bare hands. Goofy story. It was great. And it's great fun. And I like Manistee. And so when I invented Bitterfrost, I was thinking of Manistee. And Bitterfrost has a river called the Jayco. It's Finnish for division. That runs right through the middle of town, and it helps with some of the divisions that are in the town and between the two main families that happen to be in Bitterfrost.
Very interesting. Now, Bitterfrost, of course, in addition to the main characters, hockey plays a big part, ice hockey.
Yep.
And obviously your first series started was built around ice hockey too. And so are all your books, does ice hockey play a role in all of your books?
There's, Starvation Lake is narrated by a hockey goaltender. So there's no escaping it there. And the first book is about the death of a hockey coach. So those three books, hockey, Bleak Harbor, almost no hockey. There's one scene in a hockey rink.
Okay.
But it doesn't really have much to do with hockey. It's just coincidental. In the backdrop of the fifth book, Purgatory Bay, there's a girls' hockey tournament, and some of the action takes place in the rink. And in Bitterfrost, of course, it's about a guy who used to be a hockey fighter, who was a really good player. And so that's the center of the story. And the Ice Kings is an elite amateur team, you know, young guys. Mm. Who play in the town of Bitterfrost. And that's the one thing that everybody in Bitterfrost can agree on. They love the Ice Kings.
Right. So It seems like from reading this that people who are into hockey are really, really, really into hockey.
Yeah, it's the best game. It's fast and it's really simple. Most people say, well, there's so many rules. Really, no. Just don't hit people with your stick. Stay between the puck and the net, your own net, you win. It's a simple game. No more complicated than soccer. But it's so fast and it's great fun. I've been playing my whole life. And my best friends in the world are the guys I played high school hockey with in Detroit. So it's given me a lot of gifts.
So talk about Jimmy. He was a fighter, so he was really sent out onto the ice to start a fight.
Yeah.
And is that are there really players?
Yeah, more so in the past than today. But there still are some who will go out and, enforcers. If there's a bad guy on the other team who hits the star player on my team, then maybe the coach says, "Go teach him a lesson," something like that. And Jimmy, 13 years before the book starts, a good hockey player, ends up drafted. He's in the minor leagues, but he's big, he's strong, and he has an edge, for reasons that are explained to some degree in the book. And he gets into fights now and then. And he gets into one that is particularly violent, almost kills the guy, quits on the spot, leaves the rink in the middle of the game, leaves the game, in fact. But then, there's a lot of trouble that follows this, the way he injured this guy. He loses his wife, basically loses his life. And he moves back to Bitterfrost. And he takes a job as the Zamboni driver for the Ice Kings. And he lives pretty solitary life.
For those of us who aren't hockey fans, what is a Zamboni?
Zamboni is it's a machine. It's a vehicle, really. It's got, it's a big boxy vehicle with four wheels, tires, and a guy sitting on the back or a woman sitting on the back, and it goes around the ice. And resurfaces it. So after it gets all chipped up and cut and snowy when people are playing, the Zamboni goes out and scoops up that junk and then lays down a thin sheen of water that freezes almost immediately, and it's brand new ice again. So he's a pretty important person, the
So
Zamboni
I'm
driver.
assuming they do that right before a game. Do they do it during a game ever, or?
At high levels, college, the NHL, the National Hockey League, they do it in, right before the game and then after the first period and after the second period.
Okay.
Where I play, with a bunch of old fat guys, they resurface at the beginning and then not until the next game,
Okay.
which is fine.
Yeah. You're probably not cutting up the ice as much as the NHL anyway.
Maybe so. Possibly,
I loved how you kind of made Jimmy a local hero for the way he drives his Zamboni.
Yeah. Well, his Zamboni, he calls Zelda. It's really Zelda. It's really the celebrity. The
Yes.
fan. There's a bunch of fans who love Zelda and gather in one end of the rink. And she's the celebrity, and Jimmy's just her driver. But that, he's part of it, and she is a good luck charm because the Ice Kings are a pretty good team. They've won a bunch of championships since Zelda took over as the Zamboni. So, this is all superstition, obviously, Monica, but hockey is rife with superstition.
I can imagine. I can imagine. So, Brian, tell us a little bit about the kind of the plot of Bitterfrost.
Sure. So the book opens. Jimmy is on his lying on, wakes up on his kitchen floor. He's covered in blood. His hands hurt. His head hurts. His door's open. He can't remember exactly what happened or how he got there. And As it turns out, you find out he was in a bar earlier that night. He goes to the Lost Loon Tavern usually every night for one drink. He has one highball, and then he goes home. And on this particular night, there were two young guys from the Detroit area who were up there for some reason, and they were drunk, and they were harassing the barmaid, who's a friend of Jimmy's. So he intervened, not in a physical way. He's trying to calm these guys down and get them out of there for the bartender's sake. And the next day, after Jimmy finds himself covered in blood, these one of the guys is found beaten to death. And then a few days later, the other guy is found beaten to death. And so the prime suspect here is Jimmy, given his being in the wrong place at the wrong time and his past. It's really his past that, you know, bears down on him now in the present. And so he turns to a younger woman named Devin Payne, who's also a hockey player, a good one, and she's a lawyer in town. She's a member of the Payne family, which owns the rink, owns the team. So they're a rather prominent, wealthy family. And Devin takes on Jimmy's case. And on her opponent, in effect, is a detective named Garth Klimek. He's late 50s. He's been a detective for 30-some years. Curmudgeonly guy, smart guy, doesn't like hockey, doesn't know much about it.
Are you allowed to live in a small town in Northern Michigan?
Yeah, I think so. If you're a detective. And so it's Klimek's job to get marshal the evidence that will convict Jimmy. It's Devin's job to get him acquitted. And Jimmy's in the middle of this. And he can't be very much help because his memory is shot. And probably that's due to the physical stuff he encountered that night. And also because he's a fighter, he probably has some CTE. I can't pronounce the full name of CTE, but it's people who get hit in the head repeatedly, football players and hockey players, can be afflicted with CTE, and that causes temporary and sometimes permanent memory loss.
So he really doesn't know if he did it or didn't do it.
Yeah, and he knows in his heart, he knows he could have.
He knows he could have, but he also doesn't really think he did, does he?
Well, he doesn't want to think he did, obviously. Nobody wants it. You know, Jimmy's mantra since his life was turned upside down is every day is a penance. He's just trying to live this simple life and make up for his sins, which is, regardless of what caused that fight long ago, in the end, the player he hurt never played again. So Jimmy took away his livelihood and the game he loved. Mm-hmm. And so how do you cope with that? You know?
Yeah, that's sort of the central question of the book, isn't it? How do you come to terms with having ruined somebody's life?
Yeah, I'd say. Yeah, that was the question that compelled me to create Jimmy and write a story around him.
So when you decided to write this book, you started with Jimmy you had this character and then you built the plot around him. So I guess I'm asking, do you start with a single character? Do you start with a theme? Do you start with or do you have a plot and then put the characters in?
Well, I usually, Monica, always, I have an idea of what happens at the beginning or around the beginning, some bad thing. And I know two or three characters. In this case, actually the first character I knew was Devin Payne, because I had written an entire novel before I started Bitterfrost in which Devin was a major character. She was also a lawyer, a different kind of lawyer, but she was a lawyer in a little town in northern Michigan called something else. It wasn't Bitterfrost. And so I sort of knew Devin. So I'm like, okay, I know where I'm going to have a murder here. And So I might as well, I know this character because I put her on the page for the length of a book that will never be published.
Oh.
yeah, didn't get my agent going. So anyway, so I had Devin in my pocket, sort of. And in fact, there are pieces, little pieces of that book in Bitter Frost, including her backstory. But then I invented Jimmy. And of course, I need a detective. And so I created Garth Klimek. And we're off, right?
Right.
But the beginning of the book, after Severn House, the UK publisher, bought the book, and I turned it in. Well, they had it, but so my editor came back to me, and before we got into a full edit, she said, you know, chapter six, at that time, chapter six was Jimmy lying on his kitchen floor. And she said, I think you ought to make that chapter one. So, of course, I'm a writer with an ego and insecurities. So I'm like, oh, geez, all that work, et cetera. I don't know. And in about 10 minutes, I realized he was 100% correct. And so it didn't really take that much doing to just move that right to the front. And now I think it's the perfect start. Thank God for Vic Britton, who made that suggestion. And one reviewer said, it's the first chapter is as close to brilliant as anything you'll find in crime fiction. So I'm like, what do you mean close to? So anyway, I'm really glad Victoria suggested that. And you know, you're in the middle of this intense scene and you're like, what the hell happened? Right.
Right. Right.
That's what you want readers thinking.
Now
you want to pose questions. You'll answer them eventually.
The chapters 1 to 5, did they get moved later or did they get dispersed through? Or?
Well, there's the Jimmy scene. And then in chapter 2, I just say 8 hours earlier.
Okay. Okay.
And so we build back up till
okay.
to the next morning.
Okay.
So we go to the Jimmy and he's at the rink and some stuff happens there. And then he goes to the bar and these two guys are there and the shit hits the fan, et cetera.
So at what point in the process do you know who the bad guy is?
I think in this case, I knew who the bad guy was.
Okay.
Right from the start.
Okay.
And I think, you know, readers, I've read a couple like NetGalley reviews who say, well, I figured out who the real killer was. And which is true, but that's not really the most important part, especially in a book. There's not that many characters in this book, at least main characters. So if I had that reader and she or he said, well, I figured it out on page 157, I'd say, okay, stop right there and marshal the evidence to convict this person, you think. Of course, they don't have it.
Right, right. Because
they haven't read the whole book.
They have a suspicion is what they have.
I knew who the culprit was, or sort of knew, but I had no idea how it happened and why it happened.
That was the next question. Did you know why?
That's what I work out as I go, because I have friends who are able to not only plot out the first chapter and the ending, but all the scenes and everything in between. And I'm incapable of doing that.
Do you write an outline at all?
No. I wish. I mean, when I was a journalist writing long-form narratives, I effectively wrote outlines all the time. I would, because I'm gathering all this information, and I know how the story ends.
Right.
And so I would create these detailed chronologies of the story and then use the chronology as something I would pick bits and pieces out of, and as I was building the narrative. So I had in effect an outline, and I knew how the story ends. And in fiction, I've tried to do that, Monica, and I can't get anywhere. I have to put the characters in a spot, interacting or doing whatever they do, so I can figure out what they might do in the next chapter or two chapters on. That's just the way I am. And there are people like me, and there are people like, you know, plotters.
Now, did any of the characters in Bitterfrost do something that surprised you as you were writing?
Always. Yeah. Devin did. Jimmy did. And in particular, Garth Klimek, who faces one of the most difficult decisions in the book.
Right. Now, why don't we talk a little bit about the backstory between Garth and Devin? Because that really kind of is also a recurring theme in the book.
Yeah. I mean, this book, certainly for Jimmy, but also for Devin and Garth Klimek, is about redemption. Mistakes, regrets you have, and now you're faced with another situation where you have you have to make choices, and you can be right back in the same bad spot you were with this previous case. And in this case, there's a previous case that Klimek investigated, and Devin was the defense lawyer for a gentleman. Well, not gentleman's a bad word. Who killed a couple of people. You know, I mean, he was just he was a psychopath, and killed them in a rather brutal fashion. It was a spectacular case, especially in a little town like Bitterfrost. And Devin got him acquitted. And then some other things happened that I don't want to say, Monica. Because they're spoilers. But suffice to say that the tension between Devin and Klimek is sustained. Because of that case, it comes back. And it's, you know, sort of layered beneath the central case about whether Jimmy Baker killed one of these guys or not.
Because neither one of them wants to get it wrong again.
Yes.
Yeah. Klimek is getting close to retirement. He definitely wants to redeem himself, even though it wasn't really his fault. What had happened earlier?
I think of Klimek, and I didn't really know this when I started writing him. I realized it later, and especially in his interactions with his wife, Chris.
Yeah.
I think he wants to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But sometimes in his position, it's difficult to do the right thing. You have to make difficult decisions. And Chris, his wife, knows him better than he knows himself, and, you know, prods him along, prompts him. And,
yeah, she's definitely on his team.
Yeah, and she's a good cook, too.
Yeah, and so you said you didn't plan to have her be such a crucial part of it?
I had no idea she was even, I mean, I knew he's 58, 59, he's in a little town, he's probably married, and he has a son named Kenneth. But I say, let's see, where would Klimek be? It's morning. He's probably having breakfast with his wife. Okay, I'm going to put him at this little nook. We'll see what happens. And I frequently do that. I'm writing a scene in the sequel right just before I got on the phone with you. And it's the same thing. I'm like in this scene. I'm like, okay, what's going to happen? And for me, it's like I'm watching a movie that somebody else wrote.
I was going to ask you about a sequel because it does seem like at the end of this book, you leave that the possibility open.
Yep. Yep.
Are all three of the main characters showing up in the sequel?
Yes. Although Jimmy will not be one of the main points of view.
Okay.
It's Devin, Klimek, a woman who appears briefly in Bitterfrost, Catriona Dulaney. She's one of the the rival family. The
I
Dulaney.
Did not like
she's
her.
Yeah. Well, okay. She's barely in there, you know.
I know, but she's nasty.
She doesn't like Devin, which is a great dynamic. And then there's a fourth character named Hooper. And Hooper is an ex cop who appeared in my debut novel, Starvation Lake, as a one-eyed hockey player. His name is Billy Hooper. He played on a team against the protagonist of those books when they were kids. And he scored a goal on our narrator, Gus Carpenter, that stuck with Gus his whole life. And so I just resurrected Billy Hooper. Just Hooper in the book. And it's been great fun to write him and make up his backstory and see what he does. I just finished writing a scene with him that I had no idea I was going to write. So
you're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Brian Grewley, author of the thriller crime novel Bitter Frost. You were just mentioning that points of view, and so the book is written sort of certain. Each chapter has a different. You kind of move between points of view by chapter, right?
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, there's a couple spots where it doesn't go Devin Klimek, Jimmy. Sometimes it might not be in that exact order.
Right. But
generally speaking, there's three points of view. So you have a chapter, you're in Klimek's head, you're in Devin's head, you're in Jimmy's head.
Now, have you ever tried writing your other books, are they all multiple points of view, or have you ever written something that's just from just the detective's point of view, or just the accused's?
The first three books, Starvation Lake, is a first person. Gus Carpenter, who is the main character, a journalist who lives in this little town and plays goalie with his buddies. Gus is the narrator in all three of those books.
None of you in that character, right?
People always ask me that. I go, well, Gus is short. I'm 6'2". Gus is bald. I'm not. Gus is not married. I am. Gus doesn't have any kids. I have 3 and 5 grandchildren. So, and I don't play goalie. But I know goalies. I think, actually, there's more of me in a different character in that book. But people ask, my knowledge of hockey and journalism, spill heavily into that book.
Right.
My wife says there's little parts of you in almost all the characters.
Well, I think that's normally the case. So why did you decide to go from writing in a first person point of view to writing in a third person multiple point of view?
After the Starvation Lake novels, I wrote Bleak Harbor, which is multiple points of view. And one of the reasons was it's a story about an autistic boy who was kidnapped. And to sustain the tension about where Danny is, Danny Peters is his name, you couldn't write it from Danny's perspective, really. It would get too claustrophobic. And similarly, I just didn't see how I could do this book where we don't know where this kid is without moving the perspectives around. And I also just wanted to do it. It was fun. And will I write another first person? It's possible. People are always asking, when are we going to see Gus come back? And I'm like, well, the problem is another publisher owns the rights to those books. And a new publisher they're not interested in doing Gus. However, Bitter Frost has a major character from the Starvation Lake novels is a judge in Bitter Frost.
Okay.
She was Gus's squeeze in the first three books. And there's an oblique reference to Gus when she's in her chambers. My sister-in-law read the book last week in about 2 days. And I said, did you catch the reference to Gus? And she goes, damn it, I have to go back. So, there's no name. It's just, it's very oblique reference, but I had to do it.
I bet your readers, your longtime readers they appreciate the callbacks.
And there's a reference to Starvation Lake because, it's a town in northern Michigan. Well, it's a fictional town. Yeah. It's in my northern Michigan, it exists. And, it was great fun to write this judge. She is a pistol. I love it. I love her. I mean, I didn't know I was going to write her.
So
and she just takes over.
Did you, when you started writing crime fiction, did you have to do much research into how police departments worked or the judicial system, or did you already have that background from your journalism?
I knew it all from watching TV. Well, the first books aren't that much of police procedural because Gus is the narrator. He's a journalist. I mean, I as the writer can only know what Gus knows, and Gus he's not a police guy, so he observes the police. In that case, Pine County Sheriff Dingus Ajo. You know, he observes him as a source. So you see some of it through, but you'll see it all through Gus's eyes. And then in Bleak Harbor, there is a police officer whose point of view is in it, Katja Malone. And yeah, I've read a good deal. I have a textbook here that a homicide detective friend of mine gave me. It's one of the seminal texts on investigations of homicides. Mm. And let me tell you, Monica, the pictures in this book are unbelievable. I mean, it's an awesome book. You can look up anything, you know, suicide that's made to look like a murder or a murder that's made to look like a suicide. Either way, and they have pictures and, you know, grotesque, you know, the cop pictures. So I learned a lot from that, and I'm not afraid to ask. My brother-in-law is a police officer, or he's retired, but he was. And my hockey buddy, John, who gave me that book, he's always happy to answer my questions. And on the law, the courtroom, I've witnessed litigation more civil than criminal. But again, you know, TV. And on this book, I had a defense lawyer from Petoskey, which is about an hour north of where I live. He's a criminal defense lawyer named Ron Varga, and he was an enormous help. I didn't even know this guy. Somebody else introduced me, and he's answering my questions and reading the manuscript. And so I put him in the book.
I was going to say, I thought so.
Yeah, I just used his name because, you know, it was fun. And he's a great guy, and he was an enormous help to me. So am I an expert on all that? I'm sure there'll be cops and lawyers who say, no, that's never going to happen. But you know what? It's fiction. And I'm going to push it. There's no such thing as lightsabers.
That is true. Is there such a thing as, I don't want to do any spoilers, but the type of submarine that we talk of that gets talked about.
Oh, yeah. Submersibles. Yeah. That's submersibles, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, a friend of mine read the book last week, and he's in federal law enforcement. And he said, Gruels, that's my nickname. Gruels, do you know that there was a submersible drug running operation between Detroit and Windsor years ago? I didn't know that, actually. I don't even know how I just tripped over submersibles. You know, they're these miniature submarines. And in particularly, I believe it was the Mexican cartels who developed these. And they skim just below the water. And they can carry enormous loads of drugs.
And are they're remote controlled?
No, I think one person sits in them.
Ah, okay.
One very, very brave person or crazy person.
Yeah.
And they're very difficult. They're difficult to track.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was cool to learn about that.
Yeah, that is cool. Say, Brian, could you read a little bit from Bitter Frost for us?
Sure. How about if I just read the opening chapter?
Perfect.
Do you have a time limit?
About 7 minutes.
Yeah, that should be fine.
Okay.
Just stop me.
Okay.
Okay. Part one, chapter one. Jimmy wakes to a pinging sound in his head and the smell of blood. He sits up too quickly, and pain blazes up from the base of his neck and wells inside his skull, like a fist forcing its way out. He shuts his eyes, trying to squeeze it away. The high-pitched pinging ebbs, but the throb persists. He opens his eyes. He's sitting on his kitchen floor in the dark. He checks the clock on the microwave, 3:53. He's still wearing the black and silver Ice King's jacket he wore to the hockey rink and then to the Lost Loon Tavern. A draft of winter air cascades over his face. He sees his back door is open 6 inches and trembling on its hinges. He gets up to close it and notices he's wearing only one boot. He hobbles outside on his booted leg. The security light blinks on. Jimmy's other boot is lying on its side on the porch step. As he squats to pull it on, he spies a ragged path of packed down snow leading away from the porch, as if someone dragged in an animal. He goes back inside, closes the door, flicks on the lamp hanging over the kitchen table. Still smelling blood, he lifts his left hand to his face. Jesus, he says. The hand is spackled with dried blood, the knuckles a hash of shredded skin and exposed bone in a shade of rust. Blood spatters the silver sleeve of his jacket from wrist to elbow. As he stares at it, the hand begins to ache like it would after pounding some guy's forehead and cheekbones in the middle of a hockey game. What did he do to himself? Or, God forbid, to someone else? He's seen his hand like this before, but it's been a long time, when he was still playing in the minors. The thrum in his skull is deafening. He can't think straight. He goes to the sink, splashes water on his face. It doesn't help. He gazes out the window over the sink. Outside is black all the way to the tree line, several hundred yards away. All Jimmy can see is his reflection in the glimmer from the overhead lamp. A strawberry of a lump has risen on his right cheek. He touches two fingertips to it. It stings. He turns the water on hot, squirts dishwashing liquid on the hand, and washes the blood off as best he can, the soap tingling into spots where the knuckle skin is shorn. The hand comes clean enough, but he'll have to put his jacket in the wash and wear something else to work. That's not ideal because it's a game day, and everyone, especially Jimmy, driver of the Zamboni, is expected to be in Ice King's gear. He checks his back pocket for his wallet. It's there, but patting himself, finds no cell phone. Maybe in the truck. He goes to the garage. It's empty. He hits the garage door opener. As it rattles upward, he sees his truck parked at an odd angle across the two-tire drive that bends through a span of sparse woods to his house. Why is the truck outside? Did his garage door opener malfunction? He can't recall. Did his one drink keep him from parking properly? Or was someone else driving? None of this is right. But he can't remember how it got wrong. His stomach clenches. He feels afraid, but doesn't know what he feels afraid of, which frightens him even more. And man, it's cold. Must be 20 below. He wraps his arms around himself and walks to the truck, shivering. Whenever Jimmy's driving, he stuffs his phone in one of the coffee cup holders on the center console. It's not in either of those. He leans across the driver's seat to check the passenger side, grabbing the steering wheel for balance. The wheel is tacky on his palm. More blood? Somebody got hurt. His breath billows white around his head. He checks the glove box, searches under the seats, rummages through the back seat. No phone. His boss will start texting him at 7 and won't stop till opening puck drop 12 hours later. He sits in the back seat, hands gripping his knees, trying to think. Did he leave the phone at the loon? He doesn't remember. He usually turns it off before he goes in. Memory loss is an occupational hazard for a former hockey fighter who took a slew of blows to the head while delivering more than his share to other heads. If a doctor opened up his skull, Jimmy suspects they'd find tangles of that CTE stuff that supposedly blots out memory and drags its bearers to an early death. Still, this morning's full-blown blackout is peculiar, more like the sort that plagued Jimmy when he was heavy into the booze, after the lawsuits and the publicity and the divorce in the child custody fight. Basically, the whole damn night from the time he left the loon is missing. He tries to picture the loon where he was sitting, Ronnie behind the bar. He recalls having words, though nothing too bad, with a couple of guys who might have been giving Ronnie a hard time. For some reason, he remembers thinking they must have been from downstate, probably Detroit or thereabouts. There was a woman in an orange hoodie. Not much else is coming. He figures he'll call Ronnie as soon as she might awake. She'll clear things up. But then he thinks, no, you have no phone.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned when you first started writing novels that you wrote a bunch, gave it to your agent, and she said, write something else, basically.
Right.
How did you have an agent at that point?
Well, I wrote a nonfiction book in the early 90s called Paper Losses. It was about a situation with the Detroit newspapers where they tried to get permission to join their business forces, which normally would be an antitrust violation. But there's a law that allows an exemption. And the story was really about the two largest newspaper companies in the country, Gannett and Knight Ridder. Knight Ridder no longer exists. But they were one and two, and they owned the News and the Free Press. I worked at the News. Free Press was three blocks away. It was a vicious competition between the News and the Free Press for news, for ads, for circulation. And this was an attempt to have an armistice. And it was a case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. So in the process of proposing that, a friend of a friend put me with an agent. And so I had an agent. So I was lucky.
And
she helped me get Starvation Lake published.
And you wrote, like you said, you got a three-book contract.
Yeah.
Now, did you ever consider continuing with that series?
I did. I thought I was kind of done, and I was offered to continue it, but I didn't for reasons that aren't worth going into. But sometimes I think, I wonder what would have happened to Gus. And Bitterfrost, actually, for people who know of that series, they'll learn a little bit about Gus and what happened.
Okay, a little bit.
And who knows? Maybe someday I'll get to write another Starvation Lake. But, you know, I'm not getting any younger. So.
None of us are. And then you mentioned how, you know, that you're with a different publisher now. How did that process happen? How did you end up with a different publisher?
Well, my first publisher of the Starvation Lake books was Simon & Schuster.
Which is pretty great for a first-time novelist.
Yeah, it was. And they were good people. Yeah. And then I ended up at Thomas & Mercer, which is an Amazon imprint. And to stay with them, you need some pretty serious numbers. My numbers, first book, Lee Carver, pretty good. Second book, not so good. So, sayonara. And then I wrote this one whole book that had Devin Payne in it. And that didn't work for my new agent. And then I wrote 30,000 words of Bitterfrost. And she told me, no, can't sell this. But I had readers, friends. One's an editor, professional. One's a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer. One is Anna Quinlan, New York Times best-selling author. And they were all reading Bitterfrost and said, you need to finish this book. Mm. It'll find a home. And I had to submit it on my own there's only a handful of publishers, maybe not even that many, who will accept submissions that don't come through an agent. Unagented, they call it. So I did that with two or three, and Severn House said yes, and here I am.
Wow. So even with, you know, being a successful author for a number of years, the journey to publishing is not always easy.
No, and, you know, I'm successful insofar as I've had books published with my name on them. But I've never, you know, at best, I'm a mid-lister, as they say. You know, and, you know, at my age, just part of my career, taking me on is a risk. Mm. And Severn House was willing to take it.
Come on, you're not that old.
I'm 67. So.
You're about my age.
Okay. I'm young.
Yes, that's right.
But, you know what I mean. You know, if I'm 32, that's
well, yeah, you've got
longer.
They can invest more in somebody that.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
The...
And I know, but it's just business. You
yeah.
know, if you get caught up in, you know, demonizing the publishing industry, it's a waste of time and energy. Just so I'm writing, I'm making up stuff, and it's going to get out there to readers. And
you're having
fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, in the next few weeks, I don't have a huge tour, but I'm going to some places where I'll probably get a lot of friends and other ringers to show up, and it'll be great to see them, and I'll get some people I don't, you know, who are strangers who just like what I do. So
yeah, that'll be fun. Yeah,
it's always fun to talk to readers.
Where are some of the places you're going?
Well, I'm going to launch it here on Tuesday, April 1st. Right at we have two great independent bookstores right downtown in Traverse City. And I'll be at Brilliant Books. And then the next night I'll be down in a suburban Detroit store, Schuller, in West Bloomfield. Then the following Wednesday, I'm in Chicago, where I've done a bunch of book events at Bookseller, great store in the Lincoln Square neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I'm going to do, I've got a thing in Plymouth, Michigan. I've got one in Fenton, Michigan. In the summer, I'm going to do, there's some really great stores up here, but they get better. Going to get better attendance during the summer when all the tourists are here. Because tourists will actually say, oh, well, there's a book signing. Let's go see that.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
So I'll
yeah.
be up in Petoskey and Bel Air, and there's a couple libraries who've hit me up. And, you know, you're probably going to sell more books online than in these, but it's fun to do.
Yeah.
And readers appreciate it. So, and I know most of the bookstore owners are nice people. It's good to see them. It'll be fun. My wife and I will have some fun doing it.
Cool. Now, I noticed on your website, which is briangruley.com, and again, that's B-R-Y-A-N.
Yes, thank you.
that you write some blog posts about different things about your books that look really interesting and fun to read.
Yeah. Well, good. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And I have a newsletter, which you can I've been writing, I've done four of them so far this year, and I have another one coming. And in the newsletters, I talk about how this book came about, what was the inspiration. There's one of all about naming characters and places, which is one of the most fun things to do when you're writing, you know, is coming up with names, particularly of minor characters and, you know, the dry cleaner, the hardware store, the drugstore, and I use friends. For that kind of stuff. So that's fun. But anyway, that's the kind of things I've been writing about in my newsletter.
So is it an email newsletter or is it on Medium or Substack? Or
it's an email newsletter. And if you go to my website, a pop-up will come up and say sign up for the newsletter.
Cool.
And
okay.
Put your email in there and you'll get it.
And I noticed that in your website it says, in small towns, you think you know people. You don't.
So. Yeah. Yeah, you don't always know them.
Yeah, yeah. I also noticed there was one other book that was with other people that you wrote.
Oh, yeah, what, Inherit the Dead.
Yeah, what's that one?
I don't know if I'm trying to think how it came about. It was John Santlofer. A really nice guy and a good author, good writer. And he got like 20 different writers, including some very big names. I think Lee Child was one of them. And we each wrote a chapter. So John would say, okay, you know, here's what the book's about. Here's what happened. And I think I wrote chapter 7, but I don't really remember. I have it here somewhere. here's what happened in chapter 6. Here's what's going to happen in 8. Your character is in this place. You're going to meet that person. Go ahead and write whatever you want to write. It was fun. Plus, I didn't have to write the whole book. Somebody
yeah.
else could go through all that agony.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was fun.
It's. I have read some books like that before, and it's interesting. You know, do you feel like the chapters, that there's any consistency in the style at all, or is it just so different that?
No, I think John was effectively the editor. And
okay.
So it was up to him to smooth things out so readers aren't startled or jarred by abrupt changes in voice and description and sentence constructions, et cetera. And I think he did a very good job at that.
Now, You were talking about paper losses being about the newspaper industry, which has changed so drastically since you would have started your career. Can you give us any predictions on the future of newspapers?
Well, I'm no expert. I've been out with business. I've been out of the newspaper business for like 15 years, and I was at a magazine previously for 5 years ago. I think it's going to continue. We're going to continue to lose, particularly local newspapers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the model, the business model was, we give you the paper essentially for nothing, and we use this to attract advertising, and that's gone. You know, started to disappear with Craigslist, and so much advertising's online. Some of those papers have accepted that challenge, and they're doing a nice job online. But, I mean, I can't remember what the ridiculously high number is of the papers we've lost in the last several years. Meantime, there are a number of efforts to come up with new ways to get people the news they need locally. And that's really important news, because the political bodies control the school, you know, the streets, police, safety, et cetera. So they need somebody to be, you know, watching over and telling people, here's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But beyond that, I can't. I have no idea.
Yeah, me neither. Well, Brian, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for joining us today on Writers'
thank
Voices.
You.
It was really
great question.
Oh, thank you. We always close with a quote, so I looked up hockey quotes, and I found one from Jim McKenney, who is a Canadian hockey player and broadcaster.
Yeah.
He said, "Half the game is mental; the other half is being mental."
That's a good one. I've never heard that one before. Great.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.